Our program today is called Likely Effects of the 2017 Federal Tax Law Changes on Individuals, Businesses, and the Economy. Now, we're very fortunate to have Professor George Yin from our University of Virginia Law School talk to us about this important topic. George is truly an expert on federal tax law. We think he'll present a balanced assessment of the bill's likely consequences, as I said, to individuals, businesses, and on the economy. His analysis will encompass both a lay explanation of tax law arcana, such as the Byrd Rule, and an even-handed practical critique of the assessments of the bill by both its supporters and opponents. And as often happens in politics these days, there's certainly plenty on both sides of the issue. Professor Yin was formerly Chief of Staff to Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. It's known colloquially as the Joint Tax Committee. It's a nonpartisan body that helps draft tax legislation, analyzes it, and prepares official revenue estimates concerning its effects. Prior to that, he was tax counsel to the U.S. Senate Finance Committee. He is a graduate of the University of Michigan, the University of Florida, and the George Washington University Law School. So, Professor Yin, thanks for being here. Please tell us all of this.
Thank you very much. It's a delight for me to be here and to join you and to talk about one of my favorite topics. Will Rogers reportedly said that the only difference between death and taxes is that death doesn't get worse every time Congress meets. I will let all of you decide on your own whether you agree with Mr. Rogers after we finish the discussion of Congress's latest product, the tax law that was enacted at the end of 2017. The 2017 Tax Act, and I should say that if you have difficulty seeing the slides, we can dim the lights and that would be fine. So if you would prefer we do that, you know, just kind of so indicate. Otherwise, you know, we'll just proceed. Is there a consensus on this issue? Is it okay? Okay, good. And if you can't hear me, let me know as well. So the 2017 Tax Act was the largest and most significant set of changes in over 30 years, ever since the Tax Reform Act of 1986. But despite the comparable significance of those two acts, the process by which they were enacted couldn't have been more different. And I highlighted in this little table that I put on the screen some of the principal differences in the legislative process of the two acts. So in 1986, the first administration proposal came out in November of 1984, and it consisted of three large volumes of material, which essentially laid out what the proposal was and the details of the proposals of how the law should be changed, laid out a number of alternatives that the Treasury Department had studied and considered and explained why they had rejected those alternatives. So there was a very thorough spelling out, if you will, of the options available at that time and why the Treasury Department was recommending a particular set as opposed to another set. Now, this report engendered a certain amount of political opposition. Various interest groups didn't like aspects of the report, and so President Reagan famously turned to the Treasury and said, "Go back and do it again." And they did. And they came up in 5 months later in May 1985 with a second report. This report also was a fairly hefty report. It was just in one volume, 500 pages. Essentially followed much of what was in the first report, but trimmed out and kind of cut down some of the more politically objectionable parts of the first report. Following that second report, Congress then got into the act. Each of the tax committees convened over 40 days of hearings, independent of one another, to examine the various proposals and hear the reactions. Subsequent to the end of hearings, each committee held what's known as a markup. A markup is a special time in the legislative process where the committee gets together to essentially decide, are we going to recommend a bill to the full House or Senate, and what exactly is going to be included in that bill? So it's a very critical, important part of step in the decision-making process. And the markup often involves a fair amount of give and take among the committee members, who don't always see eye to eye as to, first, whether there should be a bill, and second, what exactly should be in the bill. So there's some amount of debate going back and forth. In any event, they did have, each committee had a markup, and they lasted 17 and 26 days, respectively. At the end of the day, President Reagan signed the bill into law in October 1986, almost 2 years since the beginning of the process back in November 1984. On the right-hand side shows you the 2017 process. The first proposal out of the administration was a single page of bullet points. I can't actually remember offhand how many bullet points. I believe it was less than 10 bullet points. And the bullet points are like bullet points. They kind of, you know, give you a thought with obviously no detail as to exactly what this thought means or why the thought is there and so forth. There was pushback when that was released as well, and not so much because of political objection, because truly the bullet points really didn't present enough for people to object. So the main pushback was, what is the proposal? Give us some details. Give us some explanation of what you're doing. So there was a second proposal, and the second proposal was in the form of a press release. It was 9 pages long. It had a little bit more detail, elaborating a little bit on the first set of bullet points. Truthfully, the 9 pages is really an overstatement. That includes the cover sheet, which had nothing on it, and it included several sheets that had mostly blank spaces on it. So, but it was 9 pages long, so I'm being honest here. Subsequent to that, there was a bill introduced in the House to reflect what was thought to be the administration's proposal. Subsequent to the introduction of the House bill, there was neither committee held a single hearing on any of the details that was included in the bill. There was a markup. Each committee held a markup, largely pro forma, each one lasting 4 days. As you can see at the bottom, the entire process took a total of 7 weeks. You may remember in 2017, most of the legislative time was spent trying to repeal and replace the ACA. You all remember that debate and effort and so forth. And they went through a number of iterations, trying again and again and again in various ways. Ultimately, towards the end of the year, the whole effort collapsed, and the administration and the proponents in Congress kind of decided to give up on that idea. And at that point, late in the year, they decided, well, gee, we haven't done anything, and so we need to have something to do, to say we've done, at least in this first year of the administration. And so that's the 7 weeks that kind of fitted in right towards the very end of the year. Now, part of the reason why the process is so different is not really having anything to do with the current administration or the current leaders in Congress. This reflects, to some extent, trends in the process generally that have been occurring over a number of years since 1986. But certainly part of it represents choices made by legislative leaders and the particular legislative conditions. In 1986, we had divided government. The Republicans controlled the White House and the Senate. The Democrats controlled the House. In 2017, we had united government. The Republicans controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House. In this particular case, the Republicans chose to use a procedure in Congress that enabled them to pass legislation with a bare majority in either the House or the Senate. And so, in some sense, they knew from the outset that as long as they held their members, they had the votes. They could do pretty much anything that they wanted. And since this was such an important legislative priority, you know, the one shining effort, if you will, during 2017, you could imagine that they could have maybe stretched out the effort a little bit, deliberated a little bit, as a way to kind of show off this important priority to the American people, you know, to kind of display why their legislation is so positive and good and so forth, as they were suggesting. And again, at the end of the day, they knew they had the votes, so they could pass it if they wanted to. But as it turned out, they didn't choose to do that. They chose to rush it through in a way that largely hid the details from many people, almost as if they were ashamed of what they were doing, although I certainly don't think that that was the case. So it was an unusual procedure that occurred. In my discussion today, I'm planning to talk a little bit about some of the highlights affecting individuals, mostly that might directly affect you, one of you, or one of your families. All of these changes are due to schedule to expire, almost all are scheduled to expire at the end of 2025. Then I'm going to talk very briefly about some selected tax changes affecting businesses. The business changes were essentially the driving force behind the legislation, so I need to say something, but most of the details I can't begin to describe in this program. Most of those provisions do not sunset, so they don't end at the end of 2025. And then finally, I'm going to talk briefly about some of the broader significance of the legislation, including simplification, the economy, inequality, and the budget. My hope is to be done in about 45 to 60 minutes and then open it up to your questions. If you feel that you're getting too bored before I end, just put up your hand, and if there are enough hands that are up, I'll just stop, and then we'll kind of turn immediately to questions. Okay? Oh gosh, it's a hand already in the back there. Okay, so the first change I'm going to mention is the only non-income tax provision that I'm going to mention, and this is an increase in the exemption amount for estate and gift taxes. Essentially, the law doubled the exemption from $5 million to $10 million, and again, this is only through 2025. Because the law relates to inflation adjustments from an earlier period, the effect of this law is to exempt for people dying in 2018 up to a little over $11 million in taxable estate for a single person and twice that amount for a married couple. This, of course, is in addition to the exemption that many of you probably are familiar with, the annual exemption for gift giving, which currently is $15,000 per donee. So if one of you is married, the two of you can give up to $30,000 a year to each of your children, grandchildren, what have you, free of any gift tax. But in addition to that, you have certain exemption amounts if you should pass additional wealth when you die. Bear in mind that this is only levels of taxable estate. Through various means of estate planning and so forth, it's not uncommon for people who have economic wealth, economic estates, value in their estates of maybe twice this amount, being able to shrink down to a taxable amount of this level. And so essentially one way of thinking about it is that for a married couple with economic estate of maybe twice the $22 million or maybe $40 million, that person can still pass essentially all of their wealth to their children or whoever they want to pass it to, free of any estate tax. Any additional amounts then are going to be taxed, and they're taxed essentially at a flat rate of 40%. One last point I'll mention is that unlike some prior changes, there's no change in the rule allowing the step-up in basis to the heir who inherits your property. And so if you pass, for example, some appreciated stock to a child, when the child takes that stock, the child will take a starting basis equal to the value of the date of your death. So any appreciation that's been built in that has not been taxed to anybody yet will essentially never be taxed to anybody. I put on the bottom just a little data from the latest year I had available, which was 2015. And you can see even the law based on 2015 had a very few number of estates that were subject to any kind of estate tax. The total number was a little over 5,000 estates, 5,000 people who died essentially in 2017, whose estates ended up having to pay any estate tax at all. Now with the new change, as you could see, the first two lines, the people whose estates are between 5 and 10 and 10 and 20, for the most part, probably are not going to have to pay any estate tax. And so now you've shrunk that number by about 60%, two-thirds or so, so that really going forward, we're only talking about the super-duper wealthy people, people who have hundreds of estates in the hundreds of millions or billions, right? Who are going to have to pay any estate tax at all. Most people, including most very wealthy people, simply don't have to pay any estate tax. I think, in a sense, the big winners of this change are the people in the $5 to $20 million taxable estate range, which again represents essentially around 10 to 40 million real economic value estates, because those people suddenly now, because of the new law, are going to not have to pay any estate tax, even though they would have previously, and they get, of course, the basis step up for the heir, their heir, so any built-in capital gains or so forth are not going to be taxed. Okay, turning to the income tax changes, the major features are, again, only through 2025. And there are a number of them. Most of these, I think, have been well mentioned in the news media and so forth, so I'll just run through them fairly quickly. There is an across-the-board rate reduction to a top rate now of 37%. The former top rate was 39.6%. There's a significant shrinking of the scope of the alternative minimum tax, or AMT. There was a period of time where that tax was starting to hit middle-income, upper-middle-income people fairly significantly, but now that's no longer going to be the case because of both a larger exemption and a very high phase-out level. The standard deduction has been increased to $12,000 and $24,000 for a single and a married couple. This was represented as a doubling of the standard deduction. It, in fact, was a little less than doubling because with the inflation adjustments, the amounts would have been $6,500 and $13,000 in 2018 without any change. But still, as you can see, it's a hefty increase. In addition to that, of course, there's an additional standard deduction unchanged for people 65 and over and blind people, visually impaired, and those amounts for a married couple, if one of the persons in the married couple is 65 or older, you get an additional $1,300 standard deduction, and if they're both 65 or over, you get an additional $2,600. For your children or for your grandchildren, there's an increase of the child credit from $2,000 per qualifying child to from $1,000. And then finally, offsetting some of these changes is a repeal of the personal and dependency exemption, which in 2017 was a little over $4,000. So once you take it all into account, you kind of get a little bit of a sense of kind of the magnitude of the change. So just as an example, take a married couple, both of whom are 65 or older, okay? Under the law, if it hadn't been changed, they would have been entitled to a regular standard deduction of $13,000. They would have been entitled to the additional standard deduction of $2,600 because they're both over 65. And they would have been entitled to two exemptions, which would have been about $8,100. So if I got my arithmetic right, That's 15,600 and $23,700 of total exemption amount before you begin having any taxable income at all. Under the new law, you would have a standard deduction of $24,000. You would have your over 65 additional standard deduction of $2,600. So you'd have $26,600. So you've gone from $23,700 to $26,600, about a $3,000 increase. You know, certainly a larger amount that can go untaxed, a bit of a tax cut, if you will. Okay, the larger impact of these changes, which I'll come back to, is the impact on itemizing and itemized deductions, because the larger increase in the standard deduction now shifts the choice of whether you itemize or don't. When I turn to deductions and itemized deductions, the biggest single change is a new limitation on the deduction of state and local taxes. This is your state income taxes, state property taxes, and for states that don't have any income taxes, your state sales taxes. And now the newer limitation, beginning in 2018 through 2025, is to limit that deduction to $10,000 a year. You probably have been reading stories about various states, particularly high tax states, that have been devising so-called workarounds to try to get around, if you will, the effect of this rule. As you can appreciate, I think, this is portrayed at least in among many people as kind of a red state, blue state issue, because the blue states tend to be the higher tax states, and so their residents are disproportionately affected by this rule as opposed to the red states. So some number of blue states have been taking action to try to reverse the consequence of this rule. And I thought it would be helpful to you to just kind of illustrate what some of the ideas are. They're really very straightforward. Here, the example I give you is a taxpayer, a relatively high income taxpayer who is a resident of New York. I should point out that Virginia so far has not taken any action. So what I'm going to describe, Virginia has not done yet. It doesn't say that Virginia might not do it in the future, but right now they haven't taken any action. Okay. We have a relatively high income taxpayer in New York who is paying $18,000 in, let's say, total of income and property taxes to New York, and is also making a charitable contribution in the year, total contributions of $12,000. So is paying $30,000 in out-of-pocket money, but because of the new law, will be entitled to deduct only $22,000, the $12,000 to the charity, and a limit of only $10,000 in the state taxes to New York, okay? So the question is, well, what exactly is New York going to be doing with that $18,000 in state taxes? And in particular, is New York using that money mostly for what might be considered a public purpose? Public purpose being education, safety, environment, health, you know, the general. And in some sense, you kind of feel they're probably all of their money is in some general sense being done for a public purpose like that. And I should say that the law in this area is not crystal clear. But at least in other areas of the law, there is sometimes a distinction between public and private. So, for example, if a state or a locality wanted to subsidize the building, say, of a stadium to attract a new team into the area, whatever. You know, in some general sense, you can certainly think of that as a public purpose because they're trying to encourage the economy of the area and that helps all the people. But at least in other areas of the law, there's a line drawn and said, no, that's mostly a private purpose because the benefit is primarily going to, in this case, the team and the owners of the stadium and the like. So the law isn't clear, but you can kind of raise the question. And let's assume, just hypothetically for our purpose, that what New York would be doing with this $18,000 is they would at least be devoting $10,000 of it to a public purpose, an acceptable public purpose. Okay. If they did that, at the bottom of the screen, I show you just a quick summary, and we can see again the taxpayer is going to be out of pocket. $30,000 gets a $22,000 deduction. New York is going to be collecting $18,000 in taxes and using $10,000 of it for this hypothetical public purpose. leaving 8 left to do pretty much anything it wants. Now, again, probably it's going to be just using them for additional public purposes, but at this point, we don't need to really know that. They have the freedom, if you will, to spend it as they wish. And then finally, the charity and public purpose combined would be getting $22,000, $12,000 from the taxpayer, $10,000 from New York. Okay, so now their law is going to be changed, and there's a workaround. And what is the workaround? Well, the first step of the workaround is for the taxpayer to make a direct payment to this public purpose, which could be a government instrumentality, or it could be another charity, right, that provides the educational benefits, whatever it is, make a direct payment of $10,000 to that public purpose, okay? When it does that, then New York, of course, can turn around and say, well, we wanted $10,000 to go to this valuable public purpose, but now we've instructed the taxpayer to make that payment, and therefore, of course, we no longer have to make that payment, and so they stop their direct payment. And then finally, why is the taxpayer doing this? The taxpayer is doing it because New York in turn says, if you make a payment of $10,000 for this public purpose, we will give you a tax credit on your New York State taxes equal to 90% of whatever you make. So since you're making a $10,000 payment to the public purpose, you'll get a 90% tax credit or $9,000 credit, which then, of course, in turn reduces your state tax liability from the $18,000 it would have been now down to $9,000, okay? And that's the whole story. That's as simple as what the idea is. Now, looking at the bottom, again, to summarize the kind of who gets and who gives, what do we see? Well, the taxpayer now in this picture actually is out of pocket $1,000 more. Remember, in the first picture we had, the taxpayer was out of pocket $30,000. Now the taxpayer is out of pocket $12,000 to the charity, $10,000 to the public purpose, $9,000 to New York, a total of $31,000. So the taxpayer is out of pocket $1,000 more, but the taxpayer now gets to deduct all $31,000 because all of those items are deductible with the $9,000 payment to New York within the $10,000 limit. So assuming which turns out to be a $9,000 greater deduction than under the other arrangement, that $9,000 arrangement, depending on the tax bracket of the taxpayer, if the taxpayer is, say, in the 30% bracket, that $9,000 additional deduction is worth $2,700. So the taxpayer is out $1,000 more, but gets to save taxes of $2,700. Good deal for the taxpayer, right? New York is also ahead. Remember, New York had only $8,000 left over to do kind of what it wants. Now New York has satisfied that public purpose need, and now has $9,000 left over to do, again, what it wants. And finally, the charity and public purpose are still getting their $22,000. So they're kind of even Steven, if you will. Okay? All right. So the IRS, a couple of weeks ago, not very many, issued some proposed regulations. And in those regulations, they try to stop this workaround and make sure it doesn't work. And the argument that they make, relying on a doctrine, a very old recognized doctrine in the tax law, is the doctrine of quid pro quo. And the idea basically is, when you make a gift to a charity, are you getting any return benefit? If you are getting a return benefit of any significance, you have to take that into account, and that's going to reduce the amount of your gift and therefore reduce the amount that you can deduct. And so here the argument that the IRS has put out in proposed regs is, yes, you're making a $10,000 payment to a public purpose. That would be ordinarily deductible. But in exchange for that, you're getting a $9,000 tax credit. That's worth $9,000. Therefore, you should be able to deduct only $1,000 as a result of that. And of course, if that became the law, then that essentially takes away the advantage of this. Now, we don't know. You know, I think the odds are that's probably going to become law. But one thing to watch is, even though Virginia has not tried one of these workarounds, they do have in place and have had in place a number of these tax credit programs. For example, some of you may be familiar with it. There's a provision in Virginia law today which says if you make a certain kind of contribution for conservation purposes, you're entitled to get a 40% tax credit off of your Virginia taxes on the amount that you make for conservation purposes. Now that provision, which has been around for a long time and people have been, you know, some number of people use that and so forth, is now potentially threatened by this change of the law, because the argument would be, well, now you have to reduce any amount that you're contributing to the conservation purposes by the value of your tax credit that Virginia is giving you. That hasn't been the case previously. It would be or might be the case going forward. Okay, turning quickly to a few of the other changes in deductions, I'll just kind of highlight these. There is a reduced cap on the amount of mortgage interest you can deduct. Previously, you could deduct interest for a mortgage of up to $1 million in principal, and now it's been reduced to $750,000. Obviously, we're still talking about large mortgages on very large properties. This rule is only applicable to new debt going forward. So if you have old debt prior to 2018 of $1 million, you can continue to deduct the interest on that. It's only if next year or later this year you go ahead and buy a very large house and incur a very big debt are you potentially going to be subject to this rule. There's also a limitation on how much interest you can deduct on your home equity loans. Under current or under prior to 2018 law, you could deduct interest on up to $100,000 of a home equity loan. Under the new law, you can continue to do that, but only if the proceeds of the loan are used to improve or maintain the property that you own. If you use the proceeds, for example, to pay off your credit card loans and so forth like that, then you can't get the interest deduction. Medical expenses, you probably know, has been subject to a fairly high adjusted gross income threshold, which basically means that only if your expenses are really quite extraordinary do you begin to deduct any of them. The threshold has been kind of bouncing up and down in recent years. Under the new law for 2018 only, the threshold is 7.5% of AGI. After 2018, it's at least scheduled to go back up to 10% of AGI. So the bottom line effect is if you're going to get ill with a large expense, this is the year to do it, not next year. Moving expenses has been repealed. You know that that deduction only applies to moving for business purposes, like you have a new job and you have to move and so forth. If you make a personal choice of moving from one house to another house in the same locality, we've never been able to deduct those expenses. That deduction in any event affects about 1 million people every year, and that's been repealed. The personal and casualty theft loss deduction has also been repealed unless it's pursuant to a federal disaster. So what that means is if you own, let's say, a yacht that you keep in, say, Annapolis somewhere on the bay, the storm that's comes and the yacht is totally lost, and that hurricane is declared a federal disaster, then you can potentially deduct your loss as a result of that. On the other hand, if it is totally destroyed just because of a regular, ordinary storm, but not a federal disaster, then you get no deduction at all, okay? Miscellaneous itemized deductions have also been repealed. This is the category that typically people have deducted things like their union dues or their bar dues or their tax preparation costs or costs of investment advice, things of that nature. Some number of people are able to deduct those anyway. That under the new law, that's not deductible. Alimony, big change, but this big change only applies beginning next year, not this year. And what the change is, it exactly reverses the consequences that have been the case for many years. So beginning after this year, the person who makes the alimony payment can't deduct it, and the person who receives the alimony payment doesn't have to include it in income. For people whose instruments occur this year, the rules are just the opposite the way they've always been, which is if you make the alimony payment, you can deduct, you receive the alimony payment, you have to report it in income. So the message, which I'm sure you've figured out by now, is if you're planning to get divorced, and if you're planning to pay alimony as a result of that divorce arrangement, you would be well advised to get your instrument finalized before the end of this year, right? And conversely, if you're the party that's going to be receiving alimony, you would be well advised to hold off and finalize the instrument until next year. Okay, there's an overall limit on itemized deduction primarily affecting higher income people, and that's been repealed. And then finally, there's kind of the broader impact of these changes. And as I said earlier, really the main difference now is with the larger standard deduction. It makes the choice between itemizing or not itemizing a much more challenging choice for some segment of people. The numbers are roughly 30% to a third of all taxpayers have traditionally itemized. And the estimates are that with the new law, that figure is going to go down by two-thirds to about 10%. So about 10% of all taxpayers will itemize under the new law. So a big chunk of people who formerly itemized are now suddenly not going to be itemizing and just claiming the standard deduction. And that has an impact on housing. It has probably a more important impact on charities. So some number of people who have been itemizing and claiming their charitable contribution deduction are now suddenly going to be not itemizing. And suddenly they're confronted with that very difficult choice, which is, why have I been giving all of this money to charity? Is it because of, you know, my illusionary motives and so forth, or is it because I get a tax deduction? And for most people, I think, to be honest, there's a mixture. That is, I think most people are giving money because they like the charity, they want to support it, they're very generous people, but they certainly are not going to turn down the tax deduction. Now the choice is a little more stark because we're taking the tax deduction potentially away from those people, and then they have to decide, am I still giving, how much am I giving, and so forth. So charities are potentially going to be affected. State and local is certainly going to be affected, probably in two ways. One way is, as I indicated, by having a cap on the amount of state and local taxes. That's going to put pressure in the high tax states to maybe reduce their taxes a little bit, right? So that's one effect. The other effect is exactly the opposite. In fact, I just read a story, I didn't realize it. Virginia just did a little bit of an estimate to say, what is the impact of this new law on Virginia's state finances? And what they discovered, which I think seems completely correct to me, is that because the new law expanded the base a little bit, and because Virginia law basically takes the federal base and piggybacks onto it, but because Virginia law hasn't changed their rates at all, and they haven't changed their standard deduction anymore, the bottom line is Virginia law doesn't change. They actually are estimated to collect over $4.5 billion in additional taxes over the next 6 years. So that then obviously raises a question. Well, what are they going to do with the money? And, you know, that's yet to be decided. That's going to be a big debating point and so forth. But you could imagine that Virginia could decide, well, maybe we should reduce the rate a little bit. Maybe we should expand the standard deduction. Maybe we should do something else. Maybe we should put more money in the rainy day fund. Obviously, there are a number of possibilities. But that's, anyway, one of the bigger effects, if you will, on state and local finances. On the business changes, as I said, I'm going to just kind of run through them quite quickly. The headline change, which I'm sure you've probably all heard, is to reduce the corporate income tax rate from 35% to 21%. So it's a very big drop in the corporate income tax rate. In addition to that, some number of businesses, in fact, about 60% of businesses by the percentage of business income earned, are not subject to the corporate income tax. These are your partnerships, your limited liability companies, your S corporations, your self-proprietorships. And so when Congress was pushing through this big drop in the corporate income tax rate, this other large segment of businesses came in and said, well, what are we getting out of this? Because you're dropping a rate on a tax that we don't pay. So we don't get any of that benefit, right? And so they pushed and eventually did get a sizable benefit for their business income. It's about a 20, you can think of it as basically about a 20% reduction in the taxes that they pay. That one is only through 2025. The corporate rate is not sunset. And then the third bullet point is actually a very big one. You know that when you normally, when a business makes an investment in something like a machinery or equipment that is expected to remain productive for a number of years, say 5 years, the normal rule has always been that you would have to capitalize that expense and you claim a deduction through depreciation over, generally speaking, the period that's it's productive. So you would deduct it over, say, a five-year period, something like that. Under the new law, through 2022, businesses that make those kinds of investments are entitled in the first year, the year in which they make the investment, to write off the full 100% of the cost. So if they're paying $20,000 for a piece of equipment, they get to deduct $20,000 immediately. Beginning in 2023, that is gradually reduced or scheduled to be reduced, as indicated. But this is a quite a hefty additional business cut, if you will. And essentially, based on analysis that's been done over the years, shows that it provides a zero rate of tax on income produced by that capital investment, that machinery and equipment. And then finally, the last point I'll mention is a very big change in the taxation of multinational businesses. And I'm just going to illustrate this here. This is obviously something that has a lot of detail and is something that I can't begin to go, you know, to describe in any detail. But I did want to illustrate it because, truthfully, this was the single driving force behind the entire legislation. I served, as was mentioned in the introduction, I served on a staff in Congress back about 15 years ago or so. And even back then, people were complaining and complaining about the state of the law in this area. And when I say people, I mean both the affected businesses and the members of Congress, the representatives and the senators. They were all coming and saying, you know, we've got to do something. And their concerns, I would say, went back even 10 years earlier. So this is kind of at least a 25-year concern. The basic picture is, as illustrated there, I have a little squiggly line in the middle, which represents kind of the water's edge. So above the line is the United States, and below the line is everywhere else, okay? And you can see above the line a little rectangle, which I've abbreviated U.S. corporation. So you can think of that as Apple, right? Apple is a U.S. company, and obviously they've got lots of activity in the U.S. They sell to U.S. customers. They make things here. They research here. They develop things. You know, they've got a lot of U.S. operations. But they also own a whole slew of subsidiaries. And here I've just pictured one of those subsidiaries, which is located in a foreign country. It's a foreign corporation. And what does that subsidiary do? Well, that subsidiary is essentially marketing Apple products, right? It's selling some of those gadgets to people all around the world, right? And those gadgets are based on Apple's patents, Apple's know-how, Apple's you know, manufacturing and so forth. But at some point, they get down into the hands of the subsidiary, and the subsidiary markets them and sells them. And as a result of marketing and selling them in the foreign country, it's generating income from that foreign country. Okay? That's the basic picture. The real picture is many more boxes, a lot more complication. But that, in essence, is a nutshell of kind of what the situation is, not just for Apple, but for a number of multinationals in the country. Now, what's the issue? The issue is, what kind of tax should be paid on that income paid by or earned by the foreign subsidiary in the foreign country? That's the question. What kind of tax, what kind of tax should be paid on that? Now, under the law that has been true for 60 years, I would say, and only the last 25 years because of globalization has the law really become, in some people's minds, out of date. The U.S. would tax that foreign source income only to a limited extent. And it's hard to just capture in a word or two what exactly that limited extent is. What I put up there is tax avoidance type income. So Congress over the years has tried to figure out what kind of income is Apple just kind of putting in that foreign subsidiary to really avoid paying its own income. And if we can identify that, we're going to nevertheless tax Apple on that. So there's a category of income, of tax avoidance type income, that is currently taxed in the United States under pre-2018 law. Everything else, all of the other income, is taxed by the U.S. only upon a repatriation event. That is, the moment that this money that is accumulating outside the U.S. comes back to the U.S., that becomes the moment that the U.S. tax is now going to be invoked against all of that, right? And that's typically in the form of a dividend. So the foreign subsidiary declares and pays a dividend up to the Apple parent company. That's now a taxable event, and the U.S. corporate tax is going to come into play and tax that. In the interim time before that happens, the only tax in the picture, the current tax, aside from the tax avoidance type income, is the foreign country tax, right? The foreign subsidiary is located in a foreign country. It's subject to tax in the foreign country. But of course, that tax can vary greatly depending on the country. So some countries may have high taxes, but other countries may have low or no taxes, okay? That's the basic picture under pre-2018 law. Now, what's wrong with that picture? Well, a lot of objections. So one objection is that this law gives too much encouragement for the Apples of the world to put their operations offshore, right, outside of the U.S., and resulting in loss of jobs and all of the rest. Because what it does is, as long as you're not subject to this tax avoidance type income, as long as you can avoid that category of income, essentially you're not going to be paying any U.S. tax until it comes back. But you can control when and if it comes back. So during that potentially extended period that all the income is accumulating outside the U.S., there's no U.S. tax, only a foreign country tax, and you can determine which foreign country you're putting your operations in. So one of the arguments was this is giving too much of an incentive for U.S. multinationals to put their operations outside the U.S. A second objection is that even if you aren't moving your operations outside the U.S., you have an incentive to book your income outside the U.S. through some accounting mechanism. So if you think about it, you realize that the parent company and the subsidiary company, they have a business relationship with one another. They're transferring things back and forth. They're paying for things back and forth. They have the ability to determine in their transactions how much of the profits gets booked by the parent U.S. company and how much of the profits gets booked in the foreign subsidiary. They have a big incentive to book as much as they can in the foreign subsidiary. And this has been for a long time a big headache for the IRS in trying to monitor this area. Third objection, there's a U.S. tax upon the repatriation. So what does that do? Well, that means that as the companies accumulate large amounts of income offshore, they are more and more, you know, wary, if you will, of bringing that money back, because when they bring it back, they're going to be hit by a big U.S. tax. So this is what's referred to as the lockout effect, where Apple really could use the money and use the money in the U.S., but the money is outside the U.S. and it doesn't want to incur that big tax. So it kind of is deterred from doing what would be economically a good business decision. Okay, and then finally, some companies who don't like this arrangement, or and maybe they're subject too much to the tax avoidance type income, have chosen to just leave the system altogether. And the way you leave the system is relatively straightforward. Apple could one day say, guess what? We're surrendering our U.S. Place of incorporation, and we're going to incorporate it in another country outside the U.S., and now we're free of your rules. We're subject to another country's rules, but obviously we're going to pick cleverly to figure out a good country to become incorporated in. Okay, so the law now has been changed. And what is the law after 2017? Well, first thing is the law now is going to impose current U.S. tax on a larger slice of income. It's hard for me to describe about how much larger, but it's larger than was the case prior to 2018. So there's a little more of the current income that's going to be currently taxed by the U.S. And then any amounts that are not currently taxed by the U.S. are forever untaxed. They're exempt from U.S. tax. So the only tax that you would have to pay on any balance, any remaining amount, is, of course, your tax to the foreign country. You know, the hope is that with these two, plus the dramatic drop in the corporate income tax rate, the goal at least, or at least of supporters, is to kind of overcome the disadvantages I mentioned. That is, a little less of an incentive to put operations offshore, a little less of an incentive to book your profits offshore, a little less of an incentive to carry out inversions to change your place of incorporation, and also to encourage foreign investment in the United States. What's the prognosis of this? We don't know. We don't know whether this is actually going to do any and achieve any of those things or not. A lot is going to depend on three factors. One is, how are taxpayers, meaning the multinationals, meaning Apple, that has, you know, hundreds of lawyers under their belt who are working day and night trying to figure out this new law or whatever, how are they going to respond? What new strategies are they going to come up with? Are they going to be figuring out ways to avoid the law and so forth? So that's one that we don't know. Second is, parts of the new law are going to be challenged under the WTO as the legal trade subsidies. If that occurs, we obviously don't know how that's going to be reconciled by the WTO. And the last point is, a large part of the law kind of is based on the notion that the U.S. corporate rate is being dropped so significantly, which then creates kind of this incentive for people to invest in the U.S. But that's based on the existing rates in the other countries. So if the other countries decide, gee, we're going to drop our rates also, then you can see that any advantage is might well be eliminated. Okay, I see I'm running really a little long, so let me just run through a couple of things here. On simplification, basically this is a mixed bag. The large public companies, particularly with cross-border income, they've got much more complicated situations. They really have to rethink essentially all they've done and understand the new law and so forth. For the private business, smaller businesses, it's kind of mixed. Those that are very successful with a lot of high-income owners probably are going to see some additional complication because of the changed incentives. Those below that are largely exempt from those restrictions, and therefore they may see some simplification. And finally, for individuals, likewise, I would say it's mixed. The people at the very top are largely going to be not helped by this new law in terms of simplification. They're simply going to have to rethink some of their choices. Once you get down into the bottom, you know, 80-90% of the population, you certainly have the potential of simplification. Certainly those who are not itemizing and going to be claiming the standard deduction, that could be a real simplification for them. On the economic impact, there's, I think, a general consensus about the theory of how this bill would work. Whether it, in fact, will achieve that end is very much an open question. The jury is still out. The basic theory is that by cutting taxes largely on businesses, largely on capital investments by businesses, what you hope to do is you hope to give greater incentives or rewards for businesses to use more capital, invest more capital. With the lower U.S. corporate rate, the hope is that that's going to be augmented by a flow of funds coming from outside the United States. Why is capital good? Well, with the capital accumulating, that at least in theory is supposed to improve labor productivity. You can think of, you know, pretty much any business operation which, if it had, you know, more machines, better machines, smarter ideas, which is part of your capital, right, you can immediately imagine, oh, well, then per hour of work, each laborer can actually produce a little more output, right? With all of that capital added to the picture. And if that occurs, then labor is more valuable because they are more productive. And being more valuable, then the hope is that the businesses eventually are going to compete more vigorously for this more valuable labor, which will then increase wages. So that's basically the theory behind the bill. Everyone would agree that if any of this were to take place, it would take place over time, because essentially all you're doing is you're changing the incentives that may occur. Just a couple of observations in some of the short-term and then the long-term effects. In terms of the short-term effects, what have we seen so far in the last 8 or 9 months since the bill was signed? Well, one thing is the corporate receipts are down, tax receipts are down. That's not a surprise. We would have expected that. Second thing is after-tax profits of corporations are up. Well, again, not a surprise. You cut the tax cost, you're going to increase your after-tax profits. Third thing we've seen is that the market has remained high, reaching, you know, new highs or close to new highs and so forth. Not, again, a surprise if we assume that the market is to some extent responding to the higher reporting of corporate profits. The one thing that we've seen in the short term that has puzzled some people is, you may remember, within the first 3 to 5 months of the bill's passage, there were these announcements of big wage bonuses by some companies to selected workers and so forth. Proponents said, aha, see, this shows you that our bill did what we said. We said it would increase wages, and here it is. Here's your evidence. A lot of other people said, wait a second, you know, that doesn't work, because the theory of the bill is for a longer-term change in incentives. What could be happening in the first 3 to 5 months? You know, you can imagine that corporations have a little more money than they, or businesses have a little more money than they had anticipated because of the tax cuts and so forth. But, you know, corporations are not social welfare agencies. They're not in the business of handing out money willy-nilly to any segments of their organization that they like. You would ordinarily expect that they would then make larger distributions to their shareholders, either in the form of buybacks or dividends, and we've certainly seen some evidence of that. In terms of long-term effects, there is disagreement. So the disagreement is, well, you know, even if this theory is right, how is it going to actually play out? Part of the disagreement is because there's so many other factors that are going to affect the economy. The trade policy, monetary policy, foreign policy, right? A lot of other factors. We don't know what that's going to be, so we don't know how that's going to affect. And then the other two, which are the last two items I'm going to talk about, is the effects of this bill on inequality and then on the budget deficit. So in terms of inequality, we know that over the last 30, 35 years, there's been growing inequality in this country. I've just put up on the screen, I won't read it out to you, I hope you can see it for yourselves, that both in terms of income or wealth, there's been growing inequality, where essentially the people at the very top of the income and wealth scale are getting disproportionate shares from relative to previously. These numbers, incidentally, I've taken from a 2016 paper put out by Joe Stiglitz, an economist. I think the fact of inequality occurring is not really in dispute. I think what is a little bit in dispute is what should we make of that? Is that a good thing or a bad thing, and so forth? So there are some people who say that, well, inequality is kind of a necessary for and a necessary consequence of strong economic growth over the last 30, 35 years. And the argument is that for our society to work well and for us to have a strong economic engine, we always have to maintain proper incentives for the high producers and the innovators of society. We want them to work and do their thing as well as they can. And if they do, that's going to have these spillover benefits that essentially are going to benefit all of the rest of society. So we want a set of rules that does encourage that. And if in the end we see consequence of signs of encouragement, which would then show this spreading, right, that simply reflects the fact that, well, you know, our economy has done well and this system has done well. The argument would be that the rewards that the top are getting are just, in a sense, they're just rewards for being innovators and high producers. Obviously, a number of other people hold a different picture, a darker picture. They would argue that really the people who get this high amount of wealth are not so much creating wealth, but rather simply figuring out a way to get a greater share of existing wealth for themselves. And how are they doing that? Well, there could be some market distortion, like, say, a monopoly of some sort that enables them to do that. There could be some, you know, political influence that they have, where they have some connection that enables them to get a greater share and so forth. These same people who see a darker picture see a harmful consequence from this. One of the harmful consequences is the absence of cooperation and trust within society. So as society spreads further and further apart by income and wealth, you have kind of a less of a cohesion within society, a feeling that we're all part of the system and we're all going to be working together. One last point that people make is there is kind of an invidious aspect to it in terms of opportunity. So many studies have shown that young people have it. Their advantages are closely tied to the education and the wealth of their parents. And what this means is that as this grading spreading apart, the children of the very wealthy are going to remain in the very wealthy, regardless of whether they're high producers and innovators. And meanwhile, everyone else has a little bit less of a chance to move up and so forth. I see you're nodding, so I need to cut this short fairly quickly. Let me just...
I raise my hand.
Yeah. Okay, so this is the little charts that I have for the tax bill effect on inequality. And what these bars show is your increase in after-tax income. And I've broken it down by 3 years. 2018 is the first year. You notice all the bars are in the positive range, which means that that across the board, everyone is estimated to increase their after-tax income, or bottom line is everybody or most people have gotten a tax cut. You notice that the advantages or the percentage amounts have gone disproportionately to the people at the very top. The third from the right is your 95 to 99 percentile group. And those people, that would be by numbers, people who have income between roughly $300,000 and $700,000, they got the biggest benefit in 2018. 2025 picture largely the same. 2027, which is the first year or second year after the expiration of the individual income tax cuts, you notice now the picture is there are only benefits going to the very top. Essentially, the bottom 95% have no change, with the bottom two quintiles, the lowest 40% of the country, actually having a tax increase. Now, this picture has driven people to say, well, that's because of the sunset in 2025. And so what we want to do is we want to make all of those tax changes permanent and extended. And that raises obviously the problem of the deficit and the impact on the deficit. This chart here, and I'm sorry that I've almost run out of time, because this is truly my favorite chart in the whole, and I show this every year to my students. You know that when you're presented anything like this, there's always, or should be, a little suspicion in your mind of what is he showing us and what is he not showing us, right? There's a selective ability for me to tailor your attention to something. What I like about this chart is it goes back to the founding. So at least by year, you know I'm not giving you a selected picture. I'm going all the way back to 1789, and I'm showing you the relationship between so-called public debt. Public debt is the amount that the country borrows from outsiders, not internal borrowing like for the Social Security system, but debt that maybe it's borrowing from one of us or a corporation or a foreigner, whatever. Public debt as a percentage of GDP. GDP is roughly a measure of the size of the economy. And you can see through this that there was a peak moment, and it occurred in 1945, not surprisingly, right? When the ratio was at an all-time high of 113%. The dotted line shows you where we are today. We are now at 80%. And the projection is to go into clearly uncharted territory. As I say, if I had more time, I'd run through this because it's such an interesting story. The way I tell my students is, imagine you have 1 hour to talk with a visitor from Mars, and they want to know, what's your country about, right? My answer is, I would show them this chart, because you can explain essentially every major event in the country from this little picture here. Okay, why is the projection so bad? Well, really, there's just two. This is the main, or one of the main ones, which is this is a ratio of people age 65 or older to ages 20 to 64. So you can think of it as the ratio of retired people to workers, okay? And as you can see, for a good period of time, the ratio was 20%, meaning one retired person to five workers. That ratio has been changing, and it's scheduled to go to about 40%, which would be one retired person for 2.5 workers. And we are now on that upward slope. So that's part of the reason, of course, that the projections are bad. The last reason, and then I'll stop, is the higher cost of healthcare. And that's your blue line here. It shows Medicare and Medicaid, but it would also include your subsidies under the ACA. It would include your CHIP program and the like. This slide simply shows the 10-year period. I don't like to go too far out because some of these things are obviously subject to a considerable uncertainty. But as you can see, from a percentage of GDP, we're scheduled over the next 10 years to increase from about 11.7% to 15.8%. The amount of revenues as a percentage of GDP has generally been about 18 to 19%. So you realize if we get up within 10 years to 15.8%, we're using the bulk of our budget, the vast bulk, on just those three items, right? Everything else is kind of off limits. Thank you so much.
Professor Yin, thank you. I'm sure there's some good questions here. Get a mic.
The gentleman right there, Madison, two sitting next to one another.
My question is, I feel like there's a fallacy in the concept that lowering tax rates will provide more capital. Having worked all my life in small business, what drives investment is customers. If I have customers, I'm going to invest because I can sell to them and make a profit. The tax rate ultimately doesn't matter that much.
it's a complicated subject. There's certainly what you say. There's definitely validity in your topic. And I don't think people who believe in, and I'm not saying I'm necessarily one, who believes in the theory of this bill would disagree with what you just said. I think the basic argument would be that that this is one factor that we have some ability to control, and this should help. Whether it also will then generate, I mean, you could certainly imagine a very good rosy picture where if everything that the proponents have argued occurs, that's going to actually generate more customers for your business, because you're going to have more people earning a little, more people who are working, more people are earning a little more from their work, more people who have a little more disposable income, more people who can go to your shop or do whatever it is that you do and buy your good. So you can come up with a story that would say, yes, you're right, but we're not disagreeing, right? How you kind of dig down and figure that out is then a complicated story, and there is disagreement on that.
On what you said about inequality relative to the charts that you showed us, which if I heard you right and read it correctly, those are the expected effects based on the federal tax law changes only. However, as you know, we live in a country where we have fiscal federalism, and so there are going to be changes. You described one of them here in Virginia already on the state and the local level. My perception is that we've ignored that completely, except where this kind of thing pops up as it has in Virginia, and there's a few other states where they've noticed that as well. And that's an example of a direct effect. I think there will likely be indirect effects also, as we face increased debt and deficits. It's likely to affect the way in which the federal government helps or doesn't help state and local governments. And we might actually see tax increases offsetting them on the state and local level, which, as you know, I think are more regressive than the progressive code at the federal level. So aren't we looking perhaps at even greater effects on inequality than you've judged looking at the federal?
Yeah, so your point is an excellent one, and I am correct, as you're correct in saying that I'm simply showing the analysis that was made of the federal tax law changes, so it didn't figure out all those ripple effects which you've described. But I think you're exactly right. People have certainly pointed out that particularly with the budget situation and how this exacerbates the budget, the assumption is that going forward, the federal government will do less and less for society than it's been doing. And as it does that, the assumption is that at least some states, maybe not all states, but the many states and localities may feel the need to pick that up. And if they do, then where are they going to get their money? Well, they're going to have to change their taxes as well. Now, the one piece we don't know, which varies, is that it's true that in general, state and local taxes are more regressive than the federal taxes, but it doesn't have to be that way. That is, a state and local government could choose a more progressive instrument. They have less leeway, and I think, you know, sound policy should suggest that really the federal government should be doing this. To the extent there's redistribution, the federal government is the player that can most easily do that effectively. But it isn't to say that it couldn't happen. So anyway, the observation is exactly correct. And you know, bottom line is we don't know how it's going to play out.
This side, somebody over here, ask a question.
The bill that was passed last year, and your first slide showed how quickly it was, isn't a significant portion of that bill now has to be identified by the IRS, or they have to come up with a whole bunch of rulings, and that will go on for a number of years, and won't those rulings be contested and sued and X, Y, and Z happen?
Yeah, so that process has already begun, but you're correct. The IRS has already put out some proposed regs quite quickly on some of the bigger things, but and some more are due to be coming out. Once the proposed regs come out, then there's still a process that you go through before they actually become the law, and they may get amended and changed. And even after they become the law, there still may be contention, and you may have to settle it in court and so forth. So, yes, bottom line is this set of changes is going to generate a lot of controversies. I don't do any private practicing of any sort. But if I were in private practice in the tax area, I may not think this is the greatest bill, but I would kind of anticipate my work will go up a little bit, right? At least if I'm doing a good job. So,
I'd like you to comment on a possible future scenario. Back in 1986, after the tax law was passed, the withholding rates were changed, just as they have been now, and people had more money in their pocket. But then in April, after the culprits had been safely reelected, it turned out that people found that they had a bigger tax bill than they expected. So is that scenario going to be repeated?
So you're relating a story that I don't have an immediate recollection of, and I wouldn't think that that would be repeated in 2018 in any intentional way. You know, you're kind of suggesting that there was some shenanigans going on. And as I say, I don't have a recollection of 86. I happen to be one that feels the basic, I respect the basic integrity of the people that work in the IRS. And I don't think, I mean, they will take orders, obviously they're just staff and they work, but you know, they themselves are not going to be doing that. And I would think that if somebody higher up is instructing them to kind of, you know, play games in that respect, that wouldn't, in today's environment, come out in some way. So I don't really share that particular concern. I can't say it couldn't happen. A lot of things have happened that I couldn't have imagined have happened in recent periods, but I don't really anticipate that particular problem.
What I'm suggesting is that it was just a ploy to get the representatives reelected.
Yeah. Okay. But the rates were, the withholding rates were changed, as you point out, near the beginning of the year, to reflect the fact that for most Americans, the old withholding would have been too high, and they would have had be paid too much tax during the year, and then have a big refund at the end. And you know, in the ideal, you kind of try not to over withhold. And so they were doing that for that. They obviously were doing it also for political reasons, because they felt if more people saw more money in their paychecks, they would feel, oh, this is a great bill, we're going to vote for these people and so forth. What I'm disagreeing with, though, is that I think there was a legitimate reason to reduce withholding. I believe the reduction withholding was based on their best estimate of what was appropriate amount of withholding. And I don't really see that as, you know, something that it would be reversed in some way because now the political need is over, the election is done, I've gotten reelected, so to heck with you guys, right? I don't envision that.
You ended your talk with a graph here that's pointing out the ratio of workers to retirees, and basically saying if fewer people are working, the federal government has trouble paying benefits. That's obviously related to immigration, and our country has a long history of letting people come in, and those younger people become workers. There are other countries in the world that have difficulties because they restrict immigration unduly. So any changes in immigration policy affect that graph? What do you think?
Yeah, you're completely right, and had I timed my talk better, I would have could have gone in and mentioned that point. But you're exactly right that little graph showing comparing the number of retirees to workers is in general a pretty good prediction, subject to a couple of factors. The reason it's pretty good in general is because it's basically based on demographic trends that are kind of reasonably well known and well regarded. But it is subject to some important factors. One factor obviously could be a catastrophic event, which none of us hopes would occur. Another factor would be some dramatic change in immigration policy, pro or con, right? Close the borders more tightly, you exacerbate that problem. Open them a little more widely, you reduce the pressure on that problem. So that's another factor. And of course, the third factor would be something like a major healthcare discovery, which prolongs lives by 5 or 10 years. Well, we all think that's kind of a good news, but you know, it's going to be bad news from the standpoint of that ratio.
Right here.
Professor Yin, I have a question that's very, very personal, a personal note, and that is looking at your, listening to your presentation and looking at your slides, it looks like me as a single retiree living on a pension will benefit. Do you agree?
Single retiree living on a pension. I think in general I would agree, but I don't want you to share with me or share with us, but I think it depends a little on more of your story. I need to know a little more about, you know, what other income other than your pension income you may have, and factors of that sort. And I'm not asking you that information now, but as a general proposition, I think you will see, yes, a reduction in your taxes at least through 2025. After 2025, the picture's a little foggier, and again, I'd want to know a little more about the rest of your story.
To me, on the you know, the cost of Medicare and Medicaid and all that escalating, I wonder if a possible solution to all that is that older people are going to have to continue working, and that the business, and there's a lot of talent among older people, myself included, the business people will respond to that because there is a lot of talent out there, and with certain modifications, older, healthier people, mm-hmm. You know, could contribute a lot to society. They could work for less money, even less benefits, flexible hours.
Yeah.
And right now, I think I saw in the paper today, there's 650,000 jobs in this country, more than there are, you know, workers that are able to fill them.
Yeah.
I mean, there could be a tremendous upside there.
Yeah, yeah. And that is a good point. That is, of course, another factor, because my factors show the ratio of people 65 and older to others. Well, I'm assuming 65 and older are retired, but if they're not retired, then they're in the worker column, and therefore that helps that ratio somewhat. One figure that is stuck in my head that I glossed over, but I'll just share with you, is that right now, until 2030, so for another 12 years, 10,000 people in the country turn 65 every day. So, you know, so if you think about that, I mean, it reminded me of your point, which is, yes, some of those people are continuing to work, or are working and continuing to work. They haven't retired yet, and they're going to work a while more. But some number of them aren't. And those are the people that then become our collective responsibility.
All right, this is a Republican tax bill pushed mainly by the very rich and the corporations. Healthcare, people going to live longer. Healthcare costs are bankrupting people already. There are countries in where everybody has affordable healthcare, and obviously they must have a different approach to taxes. When are Americans going to wake up that this is not favoring the majority of the people? It seems to me, and as people live longer, they're going to have more health costs.
Yeah, I don't really have much of a comment on that. I mean, I certainly hear what you're saying, and I respect your view. Some people don't agree with your view, so.
This is not really a question, it's just a statement, is that when we talk about how many people there are who are looking for a job and how many jobs there are looking for people, they're not in the same place. And that's because we're such a big country, and that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
With regard to the alimony deduction, did I understand you to say that if you are deducting alimony prior to 2018, you will continue to be able to?
Yes, for this year. So the law prior to this year has always been the party that makes an alimony can deduct it. That continues to be law for instruments finalized this year. If you are about to get divorced but you don't finalize your instrument until next year and you're paying alimony, you won't be allowed to deduct that alimony.
Thank you.
No. Yeah. No, no. Yeah, it's controlled by the time of your instrument. So the instrument...
Well, if you have one that's 10 years old, you're going to continue to
Exactly, right. Sorry.
I've read some of your interesting work on corporate taxation, and I wonder if you would close with a final comment on what you would do in a more idealized situation with corporate taxation. For instance... I always viewed the recent past trend of more businesses paying through the personal income code as a positive thing for the country, and that it made things simpler and easier and more progressive in some ways. First of all, are we reversing course on that because of some of the changes here? And whether we are or not, what would you do above and beyond these changes to maybe go back to the vision of the writers in 1913, who saw corporate taxation mainly as a principal vehicle to avoid tax evasion rather than to raise revenue more than anything else.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the question. You're right that I have spent a large part of my professional life thinking about some of these issues. And I would say, at least in one respect, the changes that were made are contrary to where I would have gone. The one respect is the significant drop of the corporate income tax rate will give a tremendous incentive for people to essentially develop tax shelters. The tax shelter would be a high-income individual who has some kind of activity that's generating a lot of income to me. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to change from personally doing it or doing it through a partnership or what have you. I'm going to do it through a corporation. And by doing that, I'm now no longer going to pay, let's say, the 37% rate that I have to pay. I'm going to pay the 21% rate by the corporation. Now, to me, that's contrary to good tax policy because I'm just doing this, you know, I'm paying somebody, some lawyer accountant to advise me, and I'm, you know, I'm changing some papers around. But at the end of the day, I'm still doing the same thing. The government is getting rooked a little bit, you know, and that kind of activity spreads. So I do it, and then you do it, and then somebody else does it, and so forth. So to me, that's a step in the wrong direction. I would want a system where you would eliminate those kinds of incentives. So I would tend to agree with your point of encouraging more taxation at the individual level for businesses, even if you're through a corporation, with the line drawn between public and private. Because, you know, try as I might, I can't convert myself into Apple. So I'm never going to be taxed like Apple, right? So Apple has a different tax system. Okay, forget about it. You know, we figure out how they should be properly taxed. What I'm worrying about is people like me, just little individuals who are doing little individual things and maybe generating big lots of income, we hope, maybe paying high levels of tax, but not playing around with those kinds of games. And what this law does is it tends to encourage that again.
Professor Yen, lots to think about. Thank you very much.